Welcome to Special Sauce 2.0, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we begin with Ask Kenji, where Kenji Lopez-Alt, Serious Eats chief culinary consultant, gives the definitive answer to the question of the week that a serious eater like you has sent us.
Generally, sort of like delicate leafy herbs like cilantro, parsley, basil, they tend to not be very good in their dried counterparts. Thyme and rosemary, oregano, they actually work pretty well in their dried forms.
After Ask Kenji, a conversation with our guest today in the house, Misha Collins. He is, of course, an actor best known for his role as the Angel Castiel. Did I pronounce that right?
Castiel.
On the CW television series Supernatural, and has now written, with his wife Vicki Collins, The Adventurous Eaters Club, Mastering the Art of Family Mealtime. And finally, on today's podcast, a teachable moment from the Serious Eats Test Kitchen.
Sous vide, which is one really, really, really great way to cook chicken wings. Let's give one of these wings a try. Wings are juicy, formerly crispity and crunchity before they got doused in the sauce. Sous vide wings, they come out good.
First up, our chief culinary consultant, author of The Food Lab, Kenji Lopez-Alt. And Kenji, serious eater Ryan Daugherty wants to know, when might you want to use dried garlic powder over fresh? That goes for other herbs and spices like oregano, thyme, etc.
Yeah, well, I can tell you a couple times when I use garlic powder over fresh, and also dried herbs. For rubs, spice rubs, like something that you're going to be rubbing on your ribs before you barbecue them, mm-hmm. Something that, you know, on your pork shoulder, dry works a lot better there just because, well, the fresh tends to burn or it tends to fall off, and the dry is much easier to sort of incorporate into a rub evenly. It also stores much better. So if you make like a big batch of your rub, you can just leave it in the pantry. I also use it for things like dredging mixes. So like the fried chicken we do at my restaurant, mm-hmm. we do in the flour mixture, in the dry dredging mixture, we do garlic powder, granulated garlic, and we also do dried oregano in that. Simply because the fresh would burn if we put fresh garlic into that mixture and it adhered to the chicken, it would burn in the fryer, and the dried doesn't.
And isn't garlic powder more concentrated, Kenji? And dried garlic?
Well, not really. You know,
it's
a kind of different flavor, you know. Fresh garlic and garlic powder have pretty distinctly different flavors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's sort of like, fresh ginger versus powdered ginger.
Right.
They're sort of the same, but they have a pretty distinct flavor from each other, different flavor from each other. You know, with the garlic, some of those flavors tend to go away when you cook it a little bit. So that's why like it works all right in dredging mixtures and in rubs and stuff. But like you wouldn't be able to, you know, if you put fresh garlic on your pizza versus garlic versus granulated garlic on your pizza, it would be a significantly different flavor. And I was going to say that's actually the other case where I often like using garlic powder. Granulated garlic is sprinkling on my pizza, and I think that's just because I don't know. That's just because there's garlic powder, and you know, on every counter.
That's because it's your childhood memory.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, what about using dried herbs in things like sous vide? Like, does that make sense?
Yeah. You know, so there are some herbs. There are certain types of herbs that do better dried than other herbs. So, generally, sort of like delicate leafy herbs like cilantro, parsley, basil, things like that. They tend to not be very good in their dried counterparts. What actually happens is that they have a very large surface area, and the leaves are relatively thin. So a lot of the volatiles, the things that give them aroma, they evaporate, you know, they leave as the liquid is evaporating from them as they're getting dried. So you don't end up with a lot of that flavor. Other hardier herbs like rosemary, thyme, marjoram, oregano, herbs that actually, you know, have sort of more slightly thicker, more succulent leaves and that grow in hotter, drier climates, they tend to actually retain their volatiles a lot better than the leafier herbs.
I actually use dried rosemary a fair amount.
Mm-hmm. So things like, yeah, like thyme and rosemary, oregano, they actually work pretty well in their dried forms, especially if it's in something like a sauce or sous vide, something where there's going to be a lot of moisture added back to it.
Is there a kind of garlic powder that you prefer?
I typically use granulated garlic for, you know, for like sprinkling, and powdered garlic for if I'm putting it into like a a spice rub or something. But, you know, honestly, you know, I haven't done a formal taste test or anything like that. But I just grab whatever's there.
Right. Maybe it's a definition of a commodity.
Yeah. I think at the restaurant we get like the big, I think we use McCormick, and they're like the, you know, the big restaurant service size 1 gallon tubs.
All right. I think Ryan is in good shape. I think we have answered Ryan's question and then some.
I hope so.
So thanks, man. Talk to you next week, Kenji.
All right.
Kenji Lopez-Ault is SiriusXM's chief culinary consultant and author of The Food Lab. Do send in your questions to Kenji, to specialsauce@SiriusXM.com. Now it's time to meet Misha Collins. He is, of course, an actor best known for his role as the angel Castiel on the CW television series Supernatural, which has had an insane run, right? It's like 2008 to 2019.
Yeah, we're in our 15th season right now.
That never happens.
No, it doesn't. I don't know why they kept us on the air.
Collins is also the co-founder and board president of Random Acts, a nonprofit organization dedicated to funding and inspiring acts of kindness around the world. He's also a published poet. Very impressive, dude.
Thank you.
And has now written, with his wife, Vicki Collins, The Adventurous Eaters Club, Mastering the Art of Family Mealtime. So welcome to Special Sauce, Misha.
I'm very happy to be here.
So the first question I always ask, in your case it's particularly relevant, is tell us about life at your family table growing up. Your family table was not exactly traditional.
That is true. I was raised by a single mom. My parents separated when I was 3 years old, and I visited my father on every other weekend for most of my childhood, but he wasn't really a cornerstone of my upbringing. But my mother and my brother and our dog were a very tight family unit. And we lived in Western Massachusetts primarily growing up and moved a lot. We were in a new home, I would say on average once every 9 months or so. I think I lived in 15 places by the time I was 15.
So you were like an army brat, only you were a different kind of brat.
Right, an army brat without the parents building up a pension plan.
Right.
And without, I mean, another thing I think that an army brat family has is a cadre possibly of other kids that are going through the same experience. And I was generally going to a new school every year and meeting kids that were in fairly stable childhoods and who knew one another and who were familiar with the school. So I was always approaching schools and new towns.
You were the permanent new kid.
Yeah, with a little bit of trepidation and trying to figure out how I could ingratiate myself to the new communities and the new schools. And my mother was very eccentric and iconoclastic, and kind of she talked about the revolution a lot. I was born in 1974, and we lived through a tumultuous political time in our country, and she didn't want to have us grow up being conventional young men. So she would do things like dress me up in pink tights and paint my nails and send me off to Cub Scouts, which I think in 2020 might actually fly.
Exactly.
But in a working class community in Massachusetts, when you show up at Cub Scouts in the boys' locker room with nail polish and long hair
not so
and
much.
Pink tights, you're ostracized.
Yeah.
So I kind of had to find a way to blend in and disappear a little bit as a kid in new schools. And I think that it built a lot of character in a lot of ways and made me more resilient and adaptable and independent than I otherwise would have been. But at the same time, there's a certain, you know, lack of stable foundation that was challenging.
I had not the same kinds of travails in my own childhood. But, you know, you do become resilient and eminently adaptable, but it also has a cost. It exacts a cost that you can't deal with as you're going through it.
but you almost have to deal with it at some point in order to really resolve some of the issues that came out of it, I assume.
Yeah, I'm sure you've found the same thing, but I feel like I'm a 45-year-old man, and I'm still I'm still discovering things and unpacking them and repairing them, I think. There are definitely things that you take away from a childhood like that that give you real strength. One of the things that I love about my childhood is that I know that you don't need money to be happy, and you can get by on just about nothing. And that gives you, I think, quite a bit of power going into the world, because you don't feel beholden to the comforts of – I don't feel beholden to the comforts of money. You know,
yeah.
I can – I'm okay with scarcity. At the same time, I don't know that I was really terribly good at connecting with people
yeah.
or making friends, and I probably still struggle with that.
Yeah. So you wrote this amazing piece in the Times, and you wrote that times were often lean, but one luxury we always had in abundance was food, even if it came by the five-finger discount. My mother taught me how to steal peaches from the Stop and Shop grocery store when I was four. We were stealing from the man. It was a justified rebellion against an unjust system. So, whoa, okay, those sentences made me stop in my tracks. That's pretty intense. And I was actually thinking about this movie Shoplifters. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
Oh, yeah.
Because in there, the father figure, turns out not to be the father, teaches the kids how to steal so mm-hmm. they can eat.
Mm-hmm.
And so, wow, I mean, talk about that. That's a – talk about getting conflicting messages from your mother. It's like, whoa.
It's funny because now hearing you read that, it paints a portrait of a parent who was raising children without a moral compass, and I think that was not at all the case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was righteous rebellion. You know, we were stealing. We would never have stolen from the local co-op,
mm-hmm.
But this was from, you know, a corporate entity, and these corporations were out to exploit the proletariat. So it felt like I actually felt the exhilaration of feeling like I was part of a rebellion at that point, even, and frankly, indoctrinated into that at a really young age. At the age of four, I was aware that it was us against them. We were the, you know, we were the little guys, and that we had justice on our side. At the same time, it is, you know, it's a complicated thing to be training a little four-year-old how to steal. I have a very distinct memory of the fruit island in the Stop and Shop and me grabbing a peach. And this was the first time that I remember ever shoplifting anything. And I grabbed the peach and then I ducked down behind the island. And my mother said, no, you can't do it like that. You have to take it. You have to be very calm. You have to not look around. You can't show that you're distressed at all or that you're nervous. And then you put it in your backpack, and then we would go up to the cash register and we would pay for some of the groceries, you know, so that we were
amazing,
distracting them, and then and scoot out the door.
And you just, I assume, felt that there was nothing particularly abnormal about this because you had nothing to compare it to.
Right. Yeah. This was my normal.
Yeah. You weren't stealing from somebody who or something that needed the money. You were stealing as part of an ethos,
right?
As part of, like, this is the way we work the system to fight the man.
Right. Precisely. Yeah.
Yeah. You also wrote, and I'm going to quote a couple of more sentences from the piece because it was so beautiful. My upbringing taught me you didn't need money to be happy, that you didn't have to play by the rules, that the whole world was just begging to be explored. But now by the hindsight of fatherhood and from the comfort of a therapist's couch, I see that while my childhood had been rife with adventure, it had also been lonely and frightening and wanting. So you were always reconciling those two things, weren't you?
I wouldn't say I was always reconciling them, because as a child, I struggled at times. I felt sad and lonely, but I didn't think that it was because of my childhood.
Got it.
I thought my childhood was full of adventure, and I was proud of my childhood. Up until when I was 25, I don't think I looked back on it and thought that there had been any damage done
right.
by that.
And that there was anything dysfunctional about it.
Right. And on balance, my childhood was incredibly, I think I had secure attachment with my mother. My mother was there. She was loving. She never failed to convey that love to me and my brother. So so she served as my anchor, emotionally. And that was unfailing. But because the rest of our life was so fractured and so nomadic, she was my only anchor.
Yeah.
And
because, as you said, how do you establish connections with any kids when you're moving every few months?
Right. And when you're showing up at school in pink tights in a working class school, you're also getting alienated by your peers. And so the other kids actually ended up being kind of frightening to me.
I read your Wikipedia page and somehow you escaped and you ended up at a prep school, Northfield Mount Hermon, and then the University of Chicago. What a narrative your life has been. Like, how did that happen?
You know, now that you're asking the question, I'm reflecting on it, possibly for the first time. But one thing that I know happened as a result of my childhood and partly as a result of feeling like I wasn't fitting in with other kids is that I was a smart kid and I could win the favor of my teachers. And so when I was in school, I did very well in school. It was like the thing I could throw myself into and be safe and
wow.
and get some accolades and
some positive
and
feedback.
Some positive reinforcement. So I did well in school, and we were local we lived in the town of Northfield for a little while, which is where Northfield Mount Hermon is, and they had a program that had been implemented from the inception of the school where local day students could get pretty much a full ride if they were in need, and we were in need, so I could go to school to a fancy high school for free as a day student, and then I, you know, ended up basically getting the same deal at the University of Chicago. And
amazing.
Yeah. And I thought I was going to go at the time. I thought I was going to go into politics. So I was sort of on that a very clear path. And that wanting to go into politics was also born of my childhood and of my mother talking about politics all the time and making me and my brother very aware of, you know, the plight of people in need in our country and around the world. And it was felt like that was the right path
yeah.
for me.
Again, and this is the final sentence I'm going to read from the Times piece, because it gets us back to food, which is, I recently found an old journal in a box in the back of my closet. And on the page from a decade ago, where I had taken inventory of the good and bad of my upbringing, the word cooking is circled and underlined with urgency in the plus column, as if I was thinking that food had been the cornerstone of happiness in my youth. Elaborate on that. I mean, that's an amazing statement.
I think as a nomadic family, we moved around and we brought with us what we could. And in terms of material objects, there was very little that was a through line. But we did bring with us from place to place the tradition of sitting down for family meals every night.
Even if you were in a teepee or in a park.
Right. Even if we were sitting on a log in the woods in the rain, we would be sitting down and eating together. There were no distractions. There was never a television on. And there was no coercion in getting to the dinner table. There was no question about it, not because it was an edict that from an authority figure, but because we all just coalesced around dinner.
You
and
needed
loved it.
It was a permanent form of glue for the family, right?
Yeah, it really was important to us. And we would go spend Christmas with my mother's mother, my grandmother, and she was a cook as well. And food was a centerpiece of that family interaction. And for me, now that I have kids, I notice that when I'm feeling like a guilty or absent father, the way that I most quickly show my affection and love for my kids is I just make them food. And it's like the way that I know to convey to a child, everything's safe, everything's okay, yeah. And I love you.
But in 21st century America, and maybe all around the world, it's hard to do that, right? There are lots of pressures that are forcing people not to eat together.
Right.
You know, both parents are working, kids are all over the place, but you obviously, I think as a result of your upbringing, you know, it was important when you had a family and a wife that you made that same time for dinner.
Yeah, it feels very important to me. And I think sometimes I'm actually kind of maybe forcing my agenda of cooking on my kids. Like, come on, guys, let's make something in the kitchen. A lot of times they want to go outside and I want to, you know, work in the kitchen, and I have to check myself and say, okay, we'll go play a little bit of soccer first before we get to canning the pears.
But because the act of eating a meal and preparing it is imbued with so much more meaning for you than it is for them.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah.
So you end up being an actor, and you, I assume, you know, I'm just assuming that like all actors, you struggled for many years before you found yourself on the set of Supernatural. So tell us, in a few sentences, the arc of your acting career.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, my intention after college was to go into politics, and mm-hmm. I interned at the White House, and I got a job at NPR in Washington, D.C., and I was really disappointed with what I saw at the White House, and I thought, oh, God, I have to come up with a whole new plan here. I thought it was going to be the best and the brightest minds under one roof. This was the Clinton administration. And instead, what I found was the halls were filled with people who were sycophants, whose parents had donated money to the campaign. They were all yay-sayers. There was no real discourse about, you know, political ideas, which of course is actually what you need in an administration. You need people who are going to be in lockstep and who are going to support your decisions. But I was too young and naive to know that. So when I saw it, I thought, this is not for me. And I thought, I will try to find another way that I can have an impact. And my very... I think there's a lot of hubris in this, but I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll become an actor, I'll get famous, and then I'll parlay my celebrity into, you know, some sort of political influence.
Oh, because that happens all the time.
Right. I mean, really, really completely naive and totally full of myself. Then I moved to L.A., and I thought it was going to take a couple of years to, you know, attain a certain
level. To become rich and famous.
To be rich and famous. And it took a long time
to
become moderately comfortable and a C-list celebrity. But I, somewhere along the line, I stopped thinking about that end goal of, you know, I'm on this path so that I can have influence, blah, blah, blah. And I just started becoming an actor, and I was just acting for the sake of acting and not for this aspirational, high-minded goal. And then a couple of years ago, we got a new president, and that lit a fire under me. It was actually during the campaign when I started to think, oh, Trump might get elected. This is serious. And then my C-list celebrity started to come into play, and I thought, all right, well, I can use the platform that I have.
By the way, I think it's at least B minus, okay?
Well, you, as everyone knows, grade on a curve. So thank you for your charity. So I, in a strange way, it feels to me a little bit like it's come full circle. And now that the show's ending and after 15 seasons, I'm asking the question, okay, how can I be of use in the world? And I don't know what's next for me. I don't know if I spend a lot of time on television sets after this or not. I'm trying to do some soul searching and figure out what I really want to be when I grow up. But that's, in a nutshell, my path.
It's an amazing path, and you accomplished much more as an actor than almost any actor I know. To be a working actor and to have made some money doing it is actually an incredible accomplishment. And it's a tribute to, you know, maybe it's to the resilience you discovered you had in your childhood.
Yeah, I think possibly. I think that's all is obviously there's a lot of dumb luck that comes into play. It's not my fault that the show that I'm on has been on for 15 seasons or has the devoted fan base that it has.
Like, there are conventions for Supernatural.
We have conventions. There are tattoos with my face on them. I mean, it's hard not to be full of yourself in this context. We have a really, really devoted fan base, and it's quite remarkable to be a part of. Yeah. What was it? I think it was Freakonomics at one point. Maybe it was in the book Freakonomics, but they said that pursuing a career in acting is like pursuing a career as a drug dealer. It's very, very difficult to be one of the kingpins, to be successful in
right.
the field. The odds are so bad that it takes a certain personality that's defective in order that wants to even mm-hmm. pursue that in the first place.
Yeah.
Because, you know, 99 out of 100 people are going to fail at that. And then you're just going to be a low level, you know, street corner
right.
drug dealer
right.
or barely getting food on your table
yeah.
as a background actor.
Yeah. Well, Misha, we have to leave it right here for this episode of Special Sauce, but you're going to stick around and tell us all about your two terrific kids, West and Mason.
We just say Mason.
West and Mason.
Yes, we anglicize the French spelling.
And your wife, Vicky, and your family collaboration on the Adventurous Eaters Club. Thank you for spending so much time with us on Special Sauce.
Thank you so much for having me, and I can't wait to talk about the book.
Now it's time to head over to Serious Eats Test Kitchen to discover what our managing culinary director, Daniel Gritzer, is cooking up. No need to take notes. Details of Daniel's recipe are at SeriousEats.com.
One really, really, really great way to cook chicken wings, sous vide. Here's what sous vide can do for you with wings. Wings are the perfect part of the chicken. You've got the ideal ratio of skin. They kind of eat like dark meat because there's so much like juicy skin and all sorts of good stuff in there, but they actually cook more like white meat. And what that means is that they can dry out, especially if they're exposed to high heat for a long time. That's tricky because wings are small, so it really doesn't take very long for the heat to penetrate to the center. Drop the wings in your immersion circulator, run them for the time it takes, take them out, dry them off, fry them, you're done. Easy. All right, got my wings here. How are we gonna cook them sous vide? Well, first thing we're gonna do, it's really easy. I'm just gonna season them with salt. Flip them. If you're doing wings, you can use a vacuum sealer bag, but the cooking time is so short that I usually just revert to some gallon Ziploc bags. Load up a bag or two. If you're using Ziploc bags, what you want to do is use what's called the displacement method to press the air out. So I have a vessel of water that hopefully won't overflow while I do this, but all I'm going to do is push my bag down in there and then push, and the water will create enough pressure to more or less get the air out. It's not a perfect vacuum seal, but it's fine. I'm doing this in cold water because my sous vide bath is already heated, and if I tried to do this with the hot water bath, I'd burn my hand. I know this because I've made that mistake before and burned my hand. So got my immersion circulator set up. I have this one set to 165 degrees Fahrenheit, but what I've found with all my testing is you have really two roads you can choose that both will get you great, slightly different results. You can do 160 degrees Fahrenheit and cook the chicken for 2 hours in that bath to get wings that will end up fall off the bone tender. The bones just slide right out. Or you can do 165 degrees Fahrenheit, which is the temperature I have going in this bath right now, and just cook the wings for 1 hour. That's gonna get you wings that are so juicy and also tender, not quite the same level of fall off the bone, and just a little bit more kind of springiness still to the meat. Choose your temperature, get your chicken set up, and just lower it right into your hot water bath. And depending on the temperature you've chosen, you'll let it go for 1 or 2 hours. So once they're done, you want to take them out, arrange them on a wire rack, and dry them in the refrigerator overnight or 8 hours. Get them nice and ready for the fryer. And as it just so happens, I've already done that and I have a batch ready to go. Let me get them. All right, I got my frying station set up. I have my wings They have been dried overnight in the fridge, uncovered, just to get excess liquid off so that they fry up nice and crisp. Let's do it. Let's get some frying going on. My oil is about 400 degrees Fahrenheit. Here we go. Now we'll see how much the oil rises up. I may be able to get more wings in subsequent batches, but I don't want to overflow my pot because I've made that mistake once before and it was scary. Ah, stand back. I'm just gonna fry them till they're golden and crispy, which ballpark at this temperature is gonna be about 3 minutes. But you know, you just go by what it looks like. Because I've done the sous vide, these wings are already cooked. It's really just a matter of getting them crispy. That's all I'm trying to do here. Crispy and warm to the center. I'm doing buffalo wings to demonstrate the process right here. So I've got my little saucepan of Frank's Red Hot with some butter melting into it. That's all the sauce is. I'll serve it with some celery sticks and the blue cheese dressing. All right, here we go. Let's take out our first group. Get them onto the paper towels to drain the excess oil. In we go. Stand back. I'm gonna taste just one of these right now. It came out of the fryer. Skin is light and crispy. Let's try a wingette. Looking pretty good. Mmm. Let's sauce these babies. Give them a good stir. Get my celery sticks. I have cooked these sous vide, which is one really, really, really great way to cook chicken wings. Let's give one of these wings a try. Wings are juicy, formerly crispity and crunchity before they got doused in the sauce. I don't honestly want anything to do with the drumettes. I just want the wingettes. Sous vide wings, they come out good. You know, it's just another tool in your toolbox. It's just another option you have when you're deciding how you want to go about cooking your wings. And it gives really good results.
Details of Daniel's recipe and a video are at SeriousEats.com. That's it for today. Next week on Special Sauce, Kenji will be back to answer with his usual scientific precision your culinary question of the week. Do send in your questions to SpecialSauce@SeriousEats.com, plus the rest of Misha Collins' amazing journey into the Adventurous Eaters Club. All this on next week's Special Sauce. So long, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time.